The Guardian.
We're in the 13th day of the Edinburgh International Book Festival and our thoughts are turning to other times and other places. I'm Claire Armistead and I will be travelling with Jenny Uglow to Cumbria in the mid-19th century, where a very unusual woman constructed a very unusual building. Then it's off to the Scottish Islands with novelist Amy Sackville, whose second book deals with life and myth in Orkney. But first, Charlotte Higgins' book, Under Another Sky, ranges far and wide looking for traces of Roman influence on the UK's landscape and culture. We asked her to track down some of the artefacts they left behind in Scotland and examine what they reveal about us today.
I'm here in the National Museum of Scotland's Early People's Gallery with Dr. Fraser Hunter, and we're looking at an extraordinary piece of Roman glass. It's an elegant flask made in a lovely green colour with a long neck and an elegant handle. It's a really extraordinary object, and it was found very far north in Scotland, wasn't it, Fraser? North of Aberdeen.
Yeah, this is one of these remarkable discoveries that makes us question what we think we know about the Romans. It was found in building a railway in the 19th century at Turriff, which is northwest of Aberdeen. And amazingly, the workmen didn't put their spade through it, but spotted it in time. Now, getting Roman glass that far north is interesting, but getting a complete surviving vessel is absolutely remarkable. Must have come from a burial or something like that.
A lot of people say that the Romans really didn't sort of get to Scotland, or at least didn't conquer Scotland. And sometimes that's a little bit of a badge of Scottish pride, as, you know, at least the Romans didn't conquer us hard northerners as opposed to you soft southerners. So is that completely true? Because judging from all the wonderful objects in this Early People's Gallery, there's a lot of Roman contacts in Scotland.
I think that's entirely true. People tend to think Roman Britain stops at Hadrian's Wall, and of course we have our own wall here, the Antonine Wall, and a whole range of Roman remains beyond that. It's also not just a military story. The Romans aren't just concerned about sending the legions north to beat up the barbarians. You've got all this interest in diplomacy and politics as well, which takes Roman interests far beyond the formal frontier. So they're dealing with groups hundreds of miles beyond where Roman power or Roman military power extends.
I've heard you talk in the past, Fraser, about an extraordinary find of coins near Elgin up in Burnie, two bags of 300 coins each buried in an Iron Age camp. What's going on there?
Well, for me, this is one of the fascinating things about the story of Roman Scotland, is this interaction with the locals and the way that it's not just the legions coming in, but you have this idea of diplomacy. So at Burnie, we are 200 miles north of where the Romans were at that period, and yet they're dealing with these people essentially in frontier diplomacy. This is the politics of the time, trying to give gifts or bribe people in order to keep them quiet.
Because another part of the story is that we tend to think of the contact being normally and usually incredibly violent, and clearly it often was. When we think of Septimius Severus, the emperor, campaigning in eastern Scotland, we know that that was an incredibly brutal campaign, and that led to no trouble from that part of Scotland for the next 100 years, so that must have been extraordinarily brutal. But you're suggesting that there may have been something more subtle going on at the same time.
Yes, Rome isn't just a threat, Rome is also an opportunity. And the fact that the Romans had particularly all these flashy objects, these material goods that the locals could use, these are things you could take and use within your own power politics. You could show you were somebody important if you were eating from a Samian bowl, drinking from wine from a fine flagon like the one that's before us.
And what about the Roman people who were up in Scotland? I mean, actually, we think of them as being often from Italy. That's not true, is it?
No, there's very few Italians in Roman Scotland. I think this is one of the things people often fail to understand. They have this picture of the poor wee Italian shivering behind the Antonine Wall, dreaming of the vineyards of Italy. Of course, people are coming to the Roman frontier from all around the Roman world, many of them from equally damp and miserable parts of the world, like Belgium, for goodness sake.
Yeah, I love that. That's what I always say when people say talk about Romans shivering. It's like, I think it would have been much nicer in Scotland than it would have been in Belgium. But we have examples, don't we, in this gallery. We can see that the Roman soldiers were importing a sense of the Mediterranean lifestyle with them, because, of course, Romanness, wherever you come from as a Roman, there are certain things about being a Roman, about having a Roman life. So We know that they're, for example, they're drinking wine up here, don't we?
Yes, there's elements of what are seen as key elements of Roman lifestyle that you simply can't get from Scotland alone. You know, we are not a natural wine-growing country. So things like wine and olive oil are being brought in. And also, of course, you look at the military architecture, things like bathhouses, which are an essential part of Roman lifestyles. Every fort has one. Yet for the locals, these things are complete anathema. Why would you want these funny structures? So you're seeing a Roman lifestyle being brought in with the army, but only elements of that being selectively taken up by the locals. They choose the things that are useful to them. They don't just take what they're given. This isn't beads for the natives. So what you don't see are things like togas, things like baths. What you see instead are things like feasting and drinking equipment, jewellery, these kind of things. Things that are really useful in terms of being able to show within your own society you're somebody important.
Good Scottish tradition of having a good time and looking good. So you're suggesting that the Iron Age people who lived in Scotland were taking what was Roman, using it for themselves, and as it were, reinterpreting ideas of Romanness, which to me is a really interesting metaphor for the whole process of the way that we in later generations look at the idea of Roman Britain and change it for ourselves, reinterpret it for ourselves, give it different meanings in every generation.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Rome was adapted then and Rome is adapted now. People take what they want from it. So in prehistory, in the Iron Age, people were confronting this alien force, adapting to it and extracting things from it. So the locals were taking advantage of Rome as much as Rome was taking advantage of the locals. But of course, as you say, this idea of Rome is reinvented in every subsequent generation. And it's interesting, in my own period in the Iron Age, once Rome goes away, in a sense, it becomes even more influential. You start seeing local kings taking on Roman names. Once Rome is no longer a threat, it's no longer sitting on your doorstep with 1,000 heavily armed men, it suddenly becomes a much greater opportunity. You can look back to these supposedly golden days and use Rome as a model for the way that powerful folk react.
I mean, it's fascinating also in the 18th century when you get influential antiquaries looking at Roman Scotland. It is used for very particular and interesting political purposes. So one of the most important antiquarians in the early 18th century was a character called Sir John Clark of Pennycuick, who lived quite near here. And he was a unionist. He was a commissioner on the Acts of Union between England and Scotland. And he was clearly very invested in the idea that there was a continuity over the border and that Britannia, the idea of Britannia, which is a Roman idea, might actually have something to do with the contemporary politics of his time. And of course, not every Scottish antiquarian agreed with him. So Alexander Gordon, who is another extremely influential person, was much more invested in the idea of, well, actually, the Romans didn't manage to conquer Scotland. But I don't know, for me, this is fascinating territory because it does have a little bit of an angle on what we're all thinking about now, which is the idea of England and the idea of Scotland and whether they are together or whether they are separate. Does that have any bearing on your thinking, Fraser?
I think you're always aware of these issues because when you speak to people about the Romans, you still get these very oppositional views. Some people would very much see modern Western culture and Scotland as part of that, as being inheritors of the Roman mantle. For other people, the Romans were imperialist aggressors. So in a sense, the modern politics is also played through the way that people see the way the Romans interacted with Scotland.
We've come over from the National Museum of Scotland now to the other side of town, to the Scottish National Portrait Gallery. And we're standing in the great colonnaded entrance hall, looking at the beautiful late 19th century frieze that runs around the top of the walls. And this frieze depicts great men and women of Scotland in a sort of historical procession. So starting from the earliest peoples, coming right through, I'm looking at figures like Robert Burns and Adam Smith, Hume, Flora Macdonald, Mary Queen of Scots, of course. And this frieze starts with the Romans, or the Roman period in Scotland. And the first character to be named on this frieze is a figure called Calgarcus. The second character is Tacitus, the Roman historian who was, I'm afraid, actually from Gaul. And the third character is Agricola, who was also a Roman from Spain, in fact. So where do these people fit into Scottish history? Well, Tacitus was the historian who wrote the story of Calgarchus and Agricola. And Calgarchus isn't a really well-known figure now, but he is to Scotland perhaps what Boadicea is to England. He was the great Caledonian tribal leader who was defeated by the Romans, by Agricola, in about 81, 82, 83 AD, at a great battle in the Grampians. And what's really interesting about Tacitus's account of this battle is that Calgarchus is given a speech to deliver to his troops. I mean, clearly nobody was there to take it down, but Tacitus puts into the mouth of Calgarchus an extraordinary speech to his own troops. And Calgarchus says, "Today is going to be the day of liberty for Britain. We were born free. We are better than the Romans. The Romans are raptores orbi, the rapers, the pillagers of the world. And as soon as their troops realise who they really are, that they're not really Roman, they're actually from Gaul, they're actually from Germany, they will revolt against their leaders and we will all be free." And it's a remarkable act of historical ventriloquism because it puts into the mouth of this Caledonian leader a really bitter critique of the Roman imperial project. And of course, that bitter critique was written by a great Roman himself. This is one of the most interesting things for me about the Romans and Britain and the way the two come together. That the Romans were fascinated by the idea of their enemies and bold and brave enough in a way to make them into heroic figures, to give them a sense of nobility, and to use them as a way of offering a criticism of the Roman imperial project. This island was named Britannia by the Romans. And what fascinates me also is how that has become active in times of tension or flux and change between the relationship between England and Scotland. So, for instance, when James VI came south and became James I of England, suddenly Shakespeare starts writing plays that invoke not the mythology of England, but the mythology of Britain. So he uses Romano-British stories in his play Cymbeline to try and force an idea of Britain being an active and important idea. And I'm intrigued to see just at the moment how ideas of Britain versus England and Scotland will play out in the next year as we move towards the independence referendum. There's nothing like being interested in the very deep past to see how historically contingent national boundaries can be. But we're always told more about the teller than the past itself when we think about writing histories. So every age has had its own ideas about Roman Britain, and they tell us more about the age that those ideas are being pursued in often than the Romans themselves.
Charlotte Higgins there, and Under Another Sky is published by Jonathan Cape. There are Roman traces to be found all through Cumbria, of course, but it's a later figure who takes centre stage in Jenny Uglow's book, The Pine Cone. She's called Sarah Losh, and I was intrigued to find out why, after writing so many biographies of public men, Uglow chose such a very private woman.
I started really writing about women. I wrote about George Eliot and Elizabeth Gaskell, and they felt rather close, so actually it was a self-protecting thing to think, well, can one write also about men's lives? Sarah Losh is, as it were, the daughter of a generation that I've written a tremendous amount about. She grew up during the Napoleonic Wars in Cumbria. She was very, very private and indeed burnt a lot of her letters. So it's been a really extraordinary journey of discovery in that what she did was build. She built the most peculiar church in Cumberland where people go and they say, how did this happen? I went along and I thought, this is the work of one person's imagination. It's completely counter to everything that you associate with Victorian England. Who is she? What was she like? And really, it's a personal and small journey to discover that.
The book's called The Pine Cone. Why have you called it The Pine Cone?
The Pine Cone is a symbol which Sarah used a tremendous amount in her building. Indeed, she used two. She used the pine cone and she used the lotus. And they're both natural symbols of immortality, really, and transcendence, things that seem to live on. Like, you know, if you've got kids, the pine cone, you can collect them and they're all open in a hot day. And then you put them in water or it rains and they close. So they seem to be alive even though they're dead. And if you look back, way back in time to Mesopotamia, to the Greeks, to the Egyptians and so on, you feel find that the pine cone has always had this sort of mystery. So Sarah Losh in her building decorated her church with these symbols, particularly the pine cone and the lotus, which actually seem to have nothing to do with what you would think of as a Christian religion at the time, certainly not a Victorian one. In fact, it's sort of pagan and pantheistic. Also, there are stories attached, and the particular story attached to the pine cone was that just before she'd finished her building, an old friend was killed in the Afghan wars, in the terrible retreat from Kabul. And before he died, he'd sent home the seeds of a pine from Afghanistan. And this was germinated and grown, and the pine tree was actually planted in the churchyard. So it's an immediate image of death and life as well.
As well as painting a portrait of Sarah, you paint a portrait of what life was like in Carlisle in that period, when you've got very fast industrialisation happening and on one hand, and then you've got a small village which doesn't seem to grow at all.
Ah, yes. Yes, you have. The village of Rhea, where Sarah lived, is about 5 miles south of Carlisle. But her family were very involved in Carlisle politics, much overlooked small city because it's a border town and so on. And at that point, the whole dynamic or tension of her life is that society and industry are moving forward very, very fast. That's how she gets her money, because her family set up the very first chemical industry on the Tyne, the Newcastle links. Later, she also did very shrewd deals in selling land to the railways, very exciting sort of local stories. And yet all around are these ancient buildings, old Norman abbeys, Viking crosses, Celtic crosses. And it's that tension, which is very much one of the period, between people looking back and saying, what is this land? What is our history? Where do we come from? And at the same time, being completely obsessed with progress and forging ahead. So that her life and the things that she did look in both directions at once.
She was quite a canny dealer, wasn't she? She managed to sort of hoodwink the church a bit.
Yeah, she was. Parts of Britain are very, very odd, and this little village is very odd in that it was actually governed by a group called the 12 Men of Rhea, who met in the pub and dished out the local charities, and indeed still do. They still meet at the Plough in Rhea. Sarah's father had been the head of that, her grandfather had, but she couldn't because she's a woman. So she has to first persuade them, which she did with no problem, I think, to sell her land and so that she could start moving things. And then somehow persuade the bishop to consecrate. First of all, she said she's just going to restore the church, and then she builds this extraordinary edifice. But then how is the bishop going to consecrate it? Because it goes against all the rules of church building. I think the stories are that he was indeed very astonished, but there they all were, and they had a very good lunch at her house afterwards, and, you know, lo and behold, there you are, it's your parish church. So she was forceful. She left very, very clear notes in the church in case there was any law case or anything, so that people could see exactly what had been done. And I think nobody dared go against her, and yet she's clearly very good humoured and much loved by the local weavers who all turned up at her funeral, and you know, so a mixture.
Is there stuff in the public record about her, or were you ferreting around finding original correspondence and things? How did you find out about her?
It was hard to find out about her because she destroyed a lot of her correspondence. She also travelled. She travelled to Italy and things, and we know that in the 1870s there were journals and journals that she'd written. A few extracts survive, and that's all. Nobody knows where they've gone to. I keep hoping they will still turn up. Scoured the world, indeed. But the local record office has wonderful correspondence from friends, from the community, and wonderful, long, detailed diary kept by her uncle, who was like a second father, died before she grew up, but that gives you a very vivid picture. So it was a sort of detective. It was a putting the whole picture together.
So if anybody knows of the travel journals of Sarah Losh,
yes,
you want to hear from them.
I do. And so do the people of Rear.
Jenny Uglow, and The Pine Cone is published by Faber. We're heading north again with our third interviewee, the novelist Amy Sackville, whose second book, Orkney, has been described as a folk ballad set in an untethered landscape. She talked to Richard Lee about how she approached that difficult second book.
I think I consciously wanted to write something that was not historical, that was maybe a little bit more experimental, and I was very conscious of positioning myself as a writer, whereas with the first book I had no idea how it would be received.
So. But you didn't feel the kind of pressure of people looking over your shoulder as you were writing?
Yeah, I think I did, bit, and yeah. I think I increasingly do, actually. I think that hasn't gone away with the third book.
So. Yeah. I'm wondering, with Orkney, which came first? Was it the aging professor or the young mermaid?
I think both. I wrote a short story quite a long time ago, which made me think I could write, called Beach, and that was essentially the same dynamic, a young woman marrying a much older man, and they were on honeymoon on an island, but it was told from her point of view. Mm. And I think I was interested in kind of going back to that relationship, but thinking of it from his perspective.
So they came as a pair?
I think so, yeah. I think that's true, yeah.
Yeah, and this was very much kind of having seen what how it felt from her point of view. This was very much reversing the polarity.
Yeah, I think it's a cliche in that story. He wasn't a professor, but that idea of student marrying her teacher or her professor is sort of a cliche. But I think I'm quite interested in cliches. I'm interested in sort of received narratives and kind of subverting them or playing around with them a bit.
Because here we find them, as you say, on honeymoon, and they're there for kind of 10 days-ish or so. And he's a kind of professor of legends himself, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
He's trying to work on a book. He's trying to work right there. But he finds himself increasingly drawn to the view through his window, which is, of course, her.
Yes.
Whether she's there or not.
Yes, that's right. He's sort of collating fairy tales, largely about women and transformation and enchantment. He's sort of trying to impose those narratives on her, and she's kind of eluding them. Out on the beach now, she keeps watch, but there is no sign of a sail. She is a huddle on the shore, like some fluff-feathered bird hunkered into the puff of itself, only her white face protruding from the mass of garments. I can see almost nothing of her balled up there, not a jut of a joint or a wisp of silver. It is a dismal, chilly day, and instead of feeling cosy and cosseted indoors, I feel myself half in the mist that is encroaching, thickening over the water. It hasn't lifted. The low sun is a perfect pale disk without halo or shine, a hole-punched circle in a parchment sky. The storm has left a faded world behind, the cliffs, the sea, the neighbouring island, each a flat cutout, layered up in transparent shades of grey. Everything slightly damp to the touch. All is without contour, bland, dreary, a world heavy as lead. Nothing stirring, not even hardly the water. It neither advances nor retreats. It has made just the barest, hesitant approach up the shore towards her, an inch or two at most, and she regards it flatly, and it has barely the energy to nudge at the sand, as if all the energy has been sucked up and swallowed by the deadened sea, in which I imagine the fishes, the whales, even the mermaids floating bored, wall-eyed, flipping a listless fin once in a while for the sake of appearances, without propulsion.
There's a moment the professor is appalled when she says that she'd rather have had a sister instead of the books that she read in her lonely childhood. Yeah. I mean, after all, for him, they met through books. Mm. But then again, when she starts telling, when she kind of gets her own voice and starts telling the stories herself, the stories of Finn Folkahim and Selkies, the stories that she hasn't got from any book at all, stories that are kind of part of her heritage, his stories can't really compete with that. But of course, then again, you've written them down. Mm. And it was part of the interest to construct this kind of impossible object about oralness and writing.
Definitely. And actually, in the sort of earliest incarnation, he was writing. So the book that we're reading was a written document by him. Then I sort of, partly for sort of practical reasons, it was just awkward, the idea that he was watching her and writing it all down, and it hampered the way the narrative could flow. But also, exactly as you say, the relationship between presence and absence, both textually and in terms of her character, is kind of one of the thematic seams that run through the book.
You said that you had to do quite a lot of work on the pacing of the thing. So, I mean, how did you kind of map out the gradual evolution of his state of mind and of the story? Are there kind of pieces of paper on your wall with diagrams?
There was a lot of writing things on note cards and putting them all over the floor. I use Excel as a planning tool, which
because talk us through the kind of evolution of how he gets from arrival with his new wife to kind of disintegration.
Yeah, I think I wanted there to be a sense of the island kind of gradually closing in on him and the situation that they find themselves in gradually closing in. So he starts out extremely assured to the point of pomposity, and he sort of gradually loses his grasp on her and on himself, I suppose. He kind of, that's the ambiguity, is he enchanted by her or not? Part of the work of working out that pacing was stripping things out. I was sort of initially thinking this will be a full-length novel, and then became a bit worried and thought maybe I need to put more stuff in. And then when it went to my editor, she said, actually, no, we need to take some stuff out. So it was very much kind of paring back and making it as spare a thing as it could be.
Yeah. I mean, he's supposed to be working on his book, isn't he?
Yeah, that's
and gradually, right. I mean, it's the way in which the oral and the felt kind of gains victory over the written down. He gets to this point where he can't really write, can't really concentrate anymore. The words are swirling in front of his eye.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of space on the page then becomes more important. He sort of loses track of time and of where he is in time and space, I think.
The Still Point had a lot of material set in the Arctic. And this is, again, it's a return to the north, isn't it? What's the appeal of the north for you?
I was thinking about this the other day because I was in the Bodley and they have an exhibition about magic and books in there at the moment. There was something from C.S. Lewis talking about the appeal of northernness, which for him was encapsulated in this Rackham print, which is one of the kind of visual underpinnings of this book, although it's never overtly referenced. I think it's something to do with changeability and mutability in the way that things are kind of on borderlands or kind of phase into each other, or all of those legends about women turning into water or turning into creatures and the kind of ambiguity of where they are in that transformation.
Yeah, because I mean, the sea itself is very changeable. It has a whole suite of different moods and different... And the wind, again, the wind is brutal or keening. With these details, that's part of the kind of the joy of the for the reader. Is that part of the joy in writing it as well?
Very much so. I think the reason I used Orkney is that it is so constantly changing from one hour to the next, and the kind of permeability of sea and light and
it's
land.
Also this kind of faded nature of the place with the cliffs and the sea, the neighbouring islands all layered in transparent shades of grey as you have it. I mean, it's a very kind of slippery place to be. Yeah. Despite its kind of hard-edged ice and rock. You say you're working on a third novel now. Is it something sunny and warm?
It is. It's set in Madrid.
Madrid.
Which I'm actually struggling with a little bit to get the descriptive tone right.
It sounds like you need to go and eat some tapas.
I'm planning to do that in September.
Terrific. Well, enjoy.
Amy Sackville's Orkney is published by Granta. Tomorrow we'll be heading to Edinburgh Zoo with children's author Jill Lewis and discussing the future of the planet and its species with Tony Juniper, Eric Hirschfeld and Tony Ryan. Until then, as the Romans might say, Ave atque vale from me and my producer Ian Chambers.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.